Okay, we resume our meeting and we're going to talk insurance.
And Andrea, are you going to kick off?
Yes, so we're going to start with paper 2A, which is a direction paper only, and then once we've done that, we'll move on to papers 2B and 2C, which we'll be asking you for decisions. So Jo, would you like to kick off with 2A?
So we'll start first with agenda paper 2A. Just as a bit of background, at its May 2014 meeting, we had an education session on the adaptations for contracts with participating features, and what those adaptations are that would need to be for those contracts. At that May 2014 meeting, we described two proposed alternatives to the presentation of interest expense. And these two alternatives were an alternative, obviously, to the 2013 ED proposals for contracts with participating features. The alternatives were a bookial approach, which we discussed in both May and June, and an approach based on the effective interest rate method, which is what we're discussing today. We are asking only for directions for the purposes of directing future work and to this on whether we should develop an approach based on the effective interest rate. We are not asking whether it's appropriate to present discount rate changes in OCI, and if so, what alternative should be applied to determine the presentation of interest expense. This is a question for a future meeting. We plan to ask the ISB to make decisions relating to contracts with participating features as a whole at a future meeting. So just a reminder of what the 2013 ED proposals are. Firstly, the ED proposals meant there was a need to split the cash flows for presentation and apply different discount rates. For cash flows that do not vary with underlying items, you would have to lock in the discount rate at inception and use that for the presentation purposes of interest expense and therefore the amounts in OCI. For cash flows that vary with underlying items, the locked-in discount rate was reset or updated whenever the cash flows change. The other aspect of the 2013 ED proposals was that the locked-in discount rate was in effect the yield curve used for the calculation of the liability on the balance sheet, and so it was just locking in that yield curve. The paper goes through this analysis and discusses, first of all, whether there is a need to split the cash flows for the presentation again of interest expense, and this is in paragraph 17 to 25 of the paper. The second section of the paper discusses whether for the presentation of interest expense, you should lock in the discount rate using the yield curve calculated for the balance sheet measurement purposes or an effective interest rate. And this is in paragraph 26 to 32. The staff recommendation on both these points is in question one on paragraph 32. Staff recommends that for the presentation of interest expense and profit and loss, that the discount rate should first of all be reset for all the cash flows in the contract. This is instead of the 2013 ED proposal, which would have required the splitting of cash flows for the presentation of interest expense. And this is in response to the complexity that we heard on doing so for that presentation purposes. The second aspect of the staff recommendation is because we are resetting all the cash flows in the contract, we need to specify to which contracts this would apply to. The staff are proposing that this is for contracts where the cash flows that vary with underlying items are a substantial proportion of the total benefits to the policyholder over the life of the contract. Just as a contrast, if the contracts fail this condition, what would happen is that the discount rate for the presentation of interest expense will be locked in at inception and not reset for all that for those contracts. I should just mention that we are still consistent with the 2013 ED in the sense that the rate should be reset whenever there are changes in estimates of investment returns that result in changes in the amounts paid to policyholder, i.e. cash flows that vary with returns on the underlying items. This was supported in the feedback received on the 2013 ED. The second B paragraph in the staff recommendation is what discount rate should be locked in. Staff here are proposing for the presentation of interest expense, this should be a discount rate determined using an approach similar to the effective interest rate method. Again, this is different from the 2013 ED proposal to lock in the yield curve for the presentation of interest expense. The final section of the paper discusses whether what the implications should be for contracts with no participating features in paragraphs 33 to 34. Here, assuming that the ISB wishes to explore an approach similar to the effective interest rate method, staff are asking board members for their views and comments whether that approach should also be applied for contracts with no participating features for the presentation of interest expense. I'll stop here and get your views on the paper.
Darryl?
I'm broadly comfortable with this as one of the alternative directions that we should be exploring. I think there are possibly a few details that we would still need to work out in this process. I am really split at this stage, I think, between this as a possible approach or what we discussed last month, which was the book yield approach as a possible approach. And I think the two probably need to be understood better in relation to each other before we could make a call between them. But if the first question that staff are looking to ask us here is do we think that there is sufficient merit in this approach for you to explore further, I think the answer from my perspective would be yes, there probably is. I'm not sure I would be going on to the second part of your question,
yep,
about whether you'd explore the non-PAR contracts, okay, until we've really answered the first one.
Okay.
And I think it seems to me like there's two stages in this process, the book yield versus effective yield approach. I think they both provide, call it a foundation for something,
mm-hmm,
and we just need to understand them better before we can understand them better relative to each other before we can go down that route. And then once we make a decision, you can then make the decision, I think, or bring back to us about the OCI. Mm-hmm. About the PAR would be the next one.
Yes?
Joe, we chatted about this just briefly, but I think in making this more clear for the board, and I support the idea of exploring this, I think there's a lot of good reasons to do so, and at the end of the day we may conclude the difference between this and the book yield, frankly, is not all that significant. I think it's important, though, to understand the scope that you want to apply this to, and some of the words in here that led me to believe it, people may have different views on that, is phrases like substantial proportion, substantial share, majority, predominant. I think if we can be crisp as to what we mean, and I like the word substantial, that would help understanding what we mean and what it would apply to.
Okay. Mary?
Jen, a question for you about question one. It's dangerous for me to ask this because it just occurred to me during the tee-up, so there may be an obvious answer that I am forgetting, but this notion about instead of trying to split what's remeasured and what's not, having an all or nothing approach based on, as Pat said, maybe substantial portion, is this something that is relevant only for this alternative approach, or would it also be a relevant question to ask about the book yield?
I think the feedback that we received on the 2013 ED on the complexity of splitting cash flows, if you were to address that, you would need to address that both, whichever approach you took, either book yield or this.
This first question about complexity of splitting cash flows and do you reset or not,
yeah,
is one that comes up if we decide to permit or require presentation of the effective change in discount rate in OCI.
That's correct.
So that's independent of you know, what method we might use.
That's okay. Correct.
Because, fine, then stopping and answering that, it did seem persuasive to me, the qualitative reasoning that you had in here, that the, while splitting was conceptually pure in some ways, that the complexity of it and therefore the cost did not give sufficiently useful additional information that justified it. And also when I step back and say, somebody says to me, well, what's that number? To say, well, it's a little bit of this and it's a little bit of that. You know, just the layers, the slices approach. It makes it more a calculated number and less a, it's these cash flows measured at this rate or that rate. So I think also from a stand back, does it make sense perspective, I think the approach you're proposing here makes sense. I agree with Daryl's point in terms of considering alternatives if we were to pursue the OCI, either permission or requirement, that this, you know, deserves equal consideration, and so also would be grateful if the staff could develop it.
Okay. Gary?
Tell me, test understanding. When you say a substantial portion of the total benefits, are we talking the total contract or just the investment components of the contract?
The total contract. Because we the feedback we received was complex to split the cash flows within a contract. So they want to apply the same discount rate or reset the same discount rate for all the cash flows.
Okay, so but it says when the benefits to the policyholder as opposed to the death beneficiary.
All the benefits.
Yeah, so.
Both the death benefit as well as the investment returns?
That's correct, yeah.
And you have a sense of relative. You know, the bigger your investment portion is, presumably the more life insurance you've got. I mean, would death benefits be an insubstantial portion of the total benefits? That's how I would, if it's substantial as the investment return, then the death benefits have got to be insubstantial.
It depends on the way the contract is structured sometimes. So, for example, if you've got a fixed death benefit and an account balance building up, mm-hmm. and the benefit is in effect the difference between the account balance and the death benefit, and the nominal death benefit, then at the beginning it could be big, and then at the end it could be small. So you need to look over the whole contract and assess where you thought it was going to
over the contract life. I mean, because it's different. Because in the last day of the contract, when the person dies, I mean, that's the...
When it's paid, it's always substantial at that point, but you've got to look at the whole contract.
So it's total benefits to the policyholder and or the beneficiaries would be the way to articulate this correctly, right?
That's correct.
You need to find the policyholders, including its beneficiary.
Okay. Thank you.
Stephen.
So I don't disagree with what Daryl said. I think we should investigate this. But I've got one comment and then two questions for you. The comment is on something that Mary mentioned, which is the conceptual purity of the ED. I would challenge the conceptual purity, because I don't think when you have an arbitrary split of cash flows, there can be any conceptual purity, because it was arbitrary and we just chose a way of splitting it. My two questions are on the substantial share. I don't understand why that's even mentioned, because if the share is zero, then the EIR becomes the locked-in rate that we have for non-par. Mm-hmm. If the participation is 0.01%, then it has a very, very small difference between the rate for non-par. And the more the participation, the greater the influence of the changes in the cash flows due to the changes in the underlying items, so the greater the difference from the non-par. So inserting a substantial share arbitrary line seems to me to be pointless, because it will just, it's a spectrum from pure non-par through to 90%, 100% participation.
Do you want me to answer that question first, or you want to ask the second question?
The second question is completely different.
Oh, right. I think you're right in the sense that if you are only locking in the discount rate at the beginning, it would make very little difference. The question here is, for these contracts, you are resetting the rate. And for non-par, you do not reset the rate ever.
You only don't reset the rate because there is no participation.
Yes.
So if there is participation, you reset the rate.
But you reset the rate for all the cash flows, not just the cash flows.
No, you're only resetting the rate for, well, this may be my lack of understanding.
Yeah.
You're only resetting the rate for changes in the cash flows which relate to changes in returns on underlying items. If there are no underlying items, which is the case for non-par, there is nothing to reset, because changes in the cash flows are booked either in P&L or in CSM.
But it sounds to me, again, like a splitting question, because what people have told us is they want to reset the rate for all the cash flows in the contract. So whenever there's a change because of the investment returns have changed, they want to reset for all the cash flows in the contract.
Including the death benefit.
Including
Gary's
death
point.
Benefit.
That's the simplification piece.
All right. Well. So how does that work with our unlocking of the margin? So nothing unlocks the margin then for par contracts.
This is just simply for the presentation of interest expense. It's not a question about unlocking or the margin or not.
Well, we're going to double count, aren't we? Because then something's going to go to our OCI, and the same thing is going to go to CSM.
Not if you use a locked-in rate.
Okay, I need to see some numbers
because
it's too difficult to do in my head.
Yeah, it's too difficult to do it. But if you use the locked-in rate, I think they're both.
So you're saying that we do need the substantial share bright line?
Yes. I think if you don't have a substantial share bright line, you're bringing in the game, you know, how you're going to make this fit between some cash flows being accounted for one way and some cash flows being accounted another. Just for the presentation of interest expense.
Okay. Is my understanding correct that it is done over the full life of the contract, irrespective of the assets actually held? So in the example in this paper, it's a six-year bond, a six-year contract. You participate in 90%. You're not going to sell the asset. Nothing happens. If it were a one-year asset that you participated in, and then you participate in 90% of the returns on all of the reinvestments, would the liability line essentially be the same? Obviously subject to the, there would be different cash flows, but essentially it's done in the same way, that you project out your liability cash flows, and then you make an adjustment each period as those cash flows change. Also, would it be the same if it were, say, a variable rate asset that you held? You'd do exactly the same locking in? Because I think this could look very, very different depending upon the asset that's held, whether it's a one-year asset or variable rate asset.
I guess the question here is what the objective is you want to achieve, and this is what we need the feedback from for you to develop this further. Because you could make effective interest rate method just on the basis of the cash flows of the contract and not look at all three assets. But you could ask us to explore looking at making EIR, the approach anyway, more in line with what the assets are doing. It brings complications because you then have to know what the assets are doing. But at a simplistic term, the simplest way to apply it is to just look at the cash flows of the contract itself and project the EIR over the life of the contract. That's the simplest version. And that was why the scope was proposed to be the widest, because that's the easiest. You don't need to know what the assets are. It's just whatever the cash is the contract. If we are asking staff to explore variations, we're happy to do so. Each variation will bring its own complexity and also may result in a change in the scope, because once you bring in, well, you need to know what the assets are doing, then you need to start, again, rehashing the issues about which contracts would be caught by this version of
the I don't have variations to suggest.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that this example looks quite pretty.
Yep.
But I think it might look less pretty if it's a one-year asset or a variable rate asset.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think the purpose of the example was just to show you the difference between locking in the yield curve and locking in the IRR. That was all the example was meant to achieve. And we can bring back, you know, a discussion of the pros and cons of the IRR approach versus any other approach that you've asked us to follow up on, which is the book yield approach, and you could discuss this.
But I think it does impact whether locking in EIR or locking in yield curve gives a more sensible answer.
Right.
Because I think if it's a six-year bond, locking in the EIR makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
if it's a one-year bond, which you reinvest,
yes,
it may not make so much sense. And as far as reporting year one is concerned, actually the yield curve would give the right answer.
Right.
Would you give a choice then?
No.
So would you make it look sensible for the six-year bond or the one-year bond then?
Well, now we're getting into should we do this in the first place, aren't we?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. My case is a very simple question rather than the difficult one. Steve's. I'm just wondering, the EIR approach, is it good for example, your cash flow is less than substantial proportion of total benefits,
yeah,
for example, 70%. Then you should use locked-in rate approach, right? But the 2013, in that case, you can bifurcate the series of directly varying, indirectly, non-varying. So you can use the different approach. It seems to me this approach, EIR approach, is good for only those products that have substantial proportion of total benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of asymmetric consequences, not fair consequences between these two groups. So it's maybe one weakness of this EIR approach.
Well, I guess that comes back to the question of whether you would extend the EIR approach to all contracts or just to the contracts within the scope which you agree is the appropriate scope, which is those that have a substantial proportion of cashes that vary. So at the moment we're only asking for a tentative direction for contracts that have a substantial proportion. Depending where it goes with that, we may bring back a second paper to ask you to discuss for the other contracts whether you wish to. But we don't know yet, as Daryl and a few others have mentioned, it might be too soon to decide that until you decide what is appropriate for these contracts, participating contracts first.
Sue?
I also agree that we should have a look at this, and I also agree that it sounds right to pursue this approach of looking at all of the cash flows and trying to get away from the splitting of the cash flows.
Yeah.
Just following on from what Pat was saying, also sometimes we talk about are likely to be, sometimes we talk about are,
yeah,
and I'm not sure what likely to be means when you're estimating future cash flows based on today's assumptions, what different assumptions could be. So just if we could think about that in terms of scoping.
Okay.
And then building on what Steve said, I think that the example in this paper maybe risks lulling us into a little bit of a false sense of security, because it's a fixed rate bond and it's really dealing with preventing an accounting mismatch between the mechanics for the interest calculation for the asset and the insurance contract liability, which of course is perfectly sensible. But this is not going to be so simple, I think, when you get to things like variable interest rates. So this is sort of the case where you probably almost wouldn't really need a solution if you just had a fixed rate bond. And all of the cases we really need to think about aren't analysed. So I think we need to be careful to make sure that the scenarios that we're looking at are more realistic,
mm-hmm,
so that we make sure that the words we come up with actually make sense in practice and solve what we're trying to fix.
Okay.
Martin?
Yeah, I also think we should explore this approach, and then regarding this effective interest rate method, my understanding is okay that based on really the kind of assets which you held, I think that approach maybe work, maybe not work, and then I think I need to understand when it works and when it works.
Sure.
For example, also the book yield approach in some scenarios I think work better than this approach. And I think if we want to explore that further, we need really to understand in which kind of circumstances maybe the effective interest rate approach is a good thing, but I think in many other cases also the book yield approach can be superior.
Sure.
Yeah. And again, just to confirm, we'd be choosing between them. We're not talking about exploring both at the same time. Yeah. Just to be clear. Not an option.
Okay. I don't think we need to vote.
No.
All right, let's continue with the...
So now I would like to move to agenda paper 2B, that's a decision-making paper, so I will ask for the decision at the end. This paper discusses switch rate and NDP used for the accretion of interest on the contractual service margin and for calculating present value of cash flows that unlock the contractual service margin. And the choice here is between the locked-in rate at inception of the contract or whether the current rate should be used for that purposes. Like previous papers, this paper only considers the contracts without the participating features, and we will consider how this decision affects the contracts with participating features at the future meetings. As explained in paragraph four and illustrated in the appendix, the choice of the discount rate makes a difference for the measurement of the insurance contract. And this is because it makes a difference for the measurement of the contractual service margin at the end of each reporting period. And also it makes a difference for the recognition of the gains and losses because depending on the decision, the underwriting and investment result would be different. And therefore, because we recognize underwriting and investment results differently, the total comprehensive income for the period would be different as well. However, in total, of course, the total comprehensive income will be the same because the cash inflows and cash outflows would make a difference being the total profit or total loss for the contract. So the choice here is really related to the cost benefit that I will try to explain to you now. So starting with the benefit, the staff believe that using the locked-in rate is conceptually correct. This is because for the interest accretion, it reflects the time value of the contractual service margin as was priced in the contract. It's consistent with the revenue recognition requirements and also premium allocation approach. For the unlocking of the contractual service margin, it allows for the clear separation of the underwriting and investment results, because using current rate would inherently mean that we recognize some discount rate changes in the underwriting rather than the investment result, and consequently is not consistent with this decision to not unlock the contractual service margin for the discount rate changes. In addition, the lock-in rate was proposed before, and for the interest accretion, it was actually confirmed in 2013 ED and proposed in 2010 ED. In terms of the cost, and usually refer to the cost in terms of complexity, many constituents were concerned about using locked-in rate because the need for the tracking of the locked-in rate for the contract. Many saw the complexity similar to using locked-in rate for the presentation of the discount rate changes. However, and consequently, they proposed that the entity should be able to choose the rate as a policy choice. However, the staff believe that because this decision is about the measurement, not only the presentation, allowing for a choice would significantly decrease comparability between insurance contracts. The staff would also like to acknowledge that using current rate for the interest accretion increases complexity for those that use OCI presentation. This is because if entity follow proposal for cash flows and split the changes in the discount rate between OCI and profit or loss, the amounts would not self-reverse from the OCI. The ISB could decide not to require such separation, which decrease again consistency and understandability of the amounts, or could decide methods to make sure that the amounts would reverse from the OCI, but those methods are just more complex to calculate. Consequently, the staff recommend for contracts without participating features to use locked-in rate for both the interest accretion on the contractual service margin and to calculate present value of cash flows that unlock the margin. The staff believe that the locked-in rate is conceptually correct and provides more understandable and comparable results. In addition, the staff believe that there is complexity inherent in using both rates. So now I would like to ask if you agree with the staff recommendation or if you have any questions.
Paragraph 3, the recommendation. That's a very simple question. Here you say that for contract without participating feature, you recommend use lock-in rate. But if with participating feature, what's the suggestion?
I think this follows our approach that we've been taking, that we start first with contracts with no participating features. And then once you decide what the answer is for contracts with no participating features, then staff will look at whether we need to make adaptations to that decision for mm-hmm. contracts with participating features.
Then the reason why I ask is so is because, you know, it's long spectrum of different kind of products, and some with significant, some with minor participating features. And if you draw a line with such clear lines, then I'm not sure whether, let's assume you propose other rate, then means, you know, in contract use other rates, will not use lock-in rate. Oh, no, the contract with participate feature will use other kind of rate rather than the lock-in rate, which creates inconsistency, you know. So I will rather prefer, now let's assume we will push a different rate. Then I would rather prefer have something in between, you know, like significant others.
So, I mean, I think essentially what you're arguing is that because we've talked in the last paper about the possibility of updating the discount rate when you have a substantial proportion of participating features or whatever, you're therefore questioning whether or not a locked-in rate for unlocking and accretion would be appropriate. Is that essentially yes. your question? And I guess the arguments that ISA has provided for using a locked-in rate, if you were to carry them over and think about the question in the participating contracts in the same way, would say that you should be using the rate that was the rate you expected at the time. Now, with a participating contract, the reason we're resetting the rate is because we said we always knew that this was going to be like a variable rate instrument, and so we knew that the rate would reset over time, and when we priced that contract, we took that expectation into account. Using that logic, you might say that in that case you should apply some kind of reset rate as well, but that doesn't affect the conclusions in this paper for the locked-in rate for the non-participating contracts. In fact, if you're going to look at the participating contract using any rate, the current rate suffers exactly the same problems as well as using a locked-in rate, so you could argue it both ways.
Again, the idea is similar, like with the OCI paper. We wanted to first decide what is the right approach for the non-participating contracts. Then we want to think how it works with the participating contracts and make the adjustment if that would be necessary.
Brett?
What is the downside to offering an accounting policy choice here to entities that want to use a current rate if, let's say, substantially all their business is reported at fair value through P&L? As we've already hinted at in an attentive decision, we said that the use of OCI can be an accounting policy choice. Why not embed or include in that overall decision the choice of the interest rate as well, if in fact the reason why someone's going to opt not to use OCI is because they don't have a lot of that business and therefore using the current rate? And the reason why I'm somewhat empathetic to that view is, you know, from the beginning I always felt that we needed OCI to get this project done. Mm-hmm. However, if in fact an insurance enterprise is not going to use OCI or has limited use, I would certainly want to see the effects all reported in profit and loss. Now, the question then becomes, can I still get a distinction between what is so-called underwriting activity and investment activity? And I suppose the insurer could, through IS-1, choose to strike certain subtotals and still illustrate or display that kind of a breakout. So I don't think it's completely lost, but it certainly, I agree, would be different than a company that's using a locked-in rate. There's no question. But in theory, that company is also writing probably different products and may have a different investment strategy and what have you. And so how comparable the actual company is versus the comparability of the results, I think, is a different, you know, analysis. So I'm struggling here whether or not to just put the gavel down and say, nope, locked in across the board, or let's use an accounting policy choice.
As I explained the paper, there were similar proposals from the constituents as well.
Right.
And the way we approach it is, for the OCI, in my mind, it was a little bit different decision. Because for the OCI, we said the cash flows are measured using the current rate, and it was just about the geography where we want to present those changes. And people were saying, even users were saying, that actually maybe disaggregating this amount, which is already recognized in the total comprehensive income, might provide a useful information.
Mm-hmm.
While here, it's actually, for me, it's much more than presentation,
it's
because
measurement,
it's actually the measurement. And for me, it's almost like saying that some cash flows will be measured using the current rate, some will be locked in, so it's not only just about the presentation. So that's why, for me, the comparability would be decreased much more significantly than in the OCI decision, and that's why I think and that's why we recommended in the paper what we recommended is because we believe that, because for users it would be just not that useful if we have a different measurement for the contracts.
In some sense, I think that the OCI question is a bit of a distraction from this, because I think, remember, with OCI, the decision about an accounting policy choice was not just about the complexity of locked-in rates. There were other things as well, such as accounting mismatch, and there was a number of reasons that led to your decision for it being an accounting policy choice. For this question, I think the two questions are, what is the right rate to use, and does the cost of providing the right rate outweigh the benefit that you might get? Would an approximation do better, which is less costly, do you just as well? And I think where the OCI starts factoring into it is that the cost-benefit assessment for the OCI people is different for the cost-benefit assessment for the P&L people. But remember that even when you had only a P&L approach and you hadn't got an OCI approach, you thought at that time that a locked-in rate was appropriate and you were going to require a locked-in rate in the 2010 ED. There was a debate after the 2010 ED about whether a current or a locked-in rate was appropriate again, and you confirmed at that point as well that the information from a locked-in rate was more appropriate. So I think OCI factors into it a little bit, but it's not actually the primary driver of the answer to this question.
Chuck?
Yes, I may be asking a stupid question, but I was struggling to understand this mechanism. Actually, the CSM is the balance of present value of two cash flows. One is premium, the other is claim payment. So this is just the balance. And then as far as interest expense is concerned, we use locking rate. And then the difference of the current rate and locking in rate, cumulative amount would be recognized OCI. And recognize accrual interest based on the locking rate. That's understandable. So therefore, to me, in a sense, it's natural to use locking rate. That's, in a sense, understandable. However, when we find out the amount of CSM, it will be treated just like an independent amount, even though this was consist of two cash flows. That confused me quite a lot. And when there is an interest difference on the fulfillment cash flow, you recognize the total amount, I mean cumulative amount in the OCI, the gap, cumulative gap in the OCI. But as far as CSM is concerned, we are not going to recognize the cumulative amount of difference, interest rate difference. We wouldn't recognize it. OCI. So then, if we use just locking rate, and then there is an interest rate differences, then we do not recognize OCI. So something is missing. So that is what I'm worried. So then, eventually, if we use locking rate, eventually, aren't we overestimating the amount of CSM, because we are not recognize cumulative impact to the OCI, whereas we recognize it, the fulfillment cash flow, we recognize it OCI. So it seems not symmetrical treatment. So that confused me.
Carol, you have the answer to this question?
No, you go ahead, please.
I must be honest, I've really, really battled with this one. So let's start with that. And I've been talking to staff until very, very recently on this topic, trying to figure it out for myself. And I think, Tuck, you've actually hit the main point of why I've also found it difficult. The problem with CSM is we're not actually talking about cash flows. Mm.
Yeah.
So in order to get the cumulative change that you're talking about, you would actually be suggesting remeasuring the liability cumulatively and taking that remeasurement through OCI.
Yeah.
But this is not about cash flows. This is actually about a pure look forward and a reallocation of amounts between periods over the remaining life of the... Because it's a reallocation, it's what makes it so difficult to visualize what the right rate should be. If we were talking about cash flows and liabilities, then this is a current value model and would seem like you should always be using the current rate to remeasure. But we're not talking about cash flows. We're simply talking about allocation to different amounts.
Mm.
And I think that's why you don't get the cumulative effect.
Mm-hmm.
You also, why it probably on balance makes sense to go with the locked-in rate, because that's consistent with other places where we talk about allocation as opposed to remeasurement. Did that sound like I answered the question?
Yeah. I guess that's a difficulty, Tap, because on day one it is the residual. It is the difference between two sorts of cash flows, and it is a balance that then you need to carry on and allocate to future periods.
Yeah.
And that's all, mechanically, that's what it is.
Yeah.
We do not go out and then remeasure, because it would be very difficult, almost too difficult, to then recalculate CSM as if the premiums would have come in or not.
But if that is the case, why do we have to accrete the CSM?
It's a different sort of allocation again. Yeah.
Because it's just the difference of the gap to avoid the day one profit. Then it's just a paper balance. So it's a profit or loss. The gap which we treated to avoid the day one profit. Something like a deferred income. So then we can simply amortize it. We don't really have to accrete it. Why do we have to accrete it?
Well, in a way, it's as if you're saying that to take your point, it's derived because it's a present value amount, and it's a way of updating that present value amount without going to direct cash flows, but not full measurement.
But then again, if you say it's a present value, then behind there must be a cash flow. So it's two cash flow behind the CSM, then. We have to see the consistency of two cash flow, discount rate of two cash flow. That is the whole point of this paper. So that's why I was confusing.
That all helps us out again.
I think only because, Tuck, I've been through the same painful process that you're going through, I think.
The
way for me to think about this is to say that by present valuing all the cash flows on the first day, what we've in essence done is we've created a measurement value on day one that is equivalent to the amount we would have net settled on day one. It's the complete value of the contract captured in one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then because of the CSM passage of decision that we made a month ago, what we said is that I've received all the cash on day one, this equivalent present value, but I'm delivering the service over time. Now, if I take a revenue concept and say, well, if I received all the cash on day one, but I'm only delivering the service in a year's time, then obviously I received too little cash because I got the benefit of receiving the cash a year in advance.
Yeah.
And this is simply trying to compensate for the fact that from a present value perspective, I'm treating the money as though I got it on day one, but I'm actually delivering the services over time.
And also, I'm not sure if that won't confuse more, but in terms of the cash flow, when we think about the fixed cash flows, the discounting, what discounting does is always bring us to the final amount that we are going to pay. With the interest accretion, if we start accreting using the not locked in rate, the final amount actually is going to be different. So actually locked in is more consistent with the idea of final cash flows being set up at inception already.
But profit is always changing though.
Can I ask a follow-up question? You know, if we purely in the environment based on our original decision, no unlock, you know, Daryl, what you described seems quite straightforward. But we already decide, for many things, then the amount seems gradually not be the amount at the beginning.
I guess the thing with the unlocking is effectively we're saying that we made estimates on day one, and then on day two we've changed our estimates, and had we known about those estimates when we made them on day one, we would have made different estimates on day one, so we're trying to get consistency with those estimates. Those are the non-financial estimate type things. The discount rate is never unlocked against the margin in our model, and that's because we're saying that the discount rate is something that's happened yesterday and today and all the rest of it. It's not something that you could have made a mistake on and didn't know different, and so you can unlock the margin for it, if you want to put it that way. And so the unlocking using a locked-in rate would be consistent with the idea of, had you known about that estimate on day one, when you change your estimate on day two, you would have had a different margin. Yeah. If you use a current rate on day two to unlock the margin, then it's not the same as saying, this is what I would have estimated, this was, is what the margin would have been had I made the correct estimate on day one.
I think the margin's always anchored to the premium, and the premium is set at inception.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets at inception based on what you think interest rates are going to be.
Mm.
And that's the premiums that are within your contract boundary. It's not that you're going to charge more or less premiums. It's always going to be the premiums you've already set up in the contract. And that's why staff favor locking in the discount rate, because if you think about revenue recognition, it's the same idea there. It's how much you would have charged based on what you thought the assumptions would be, and it'd be the discount rate assumptions at that day.
Martin.
It is simply the difference between those.
And I understand why staff said, okay, it is conceptually superior to have this locked-in rate, but I ask myself the question, man, if really the constituents have said it is too costly to really then have all this kind of information, maybe 30, 40 years ago was a locked-in rate for the creation of the margin. And overall the model, there is so many judgment, and I think really, man, if they have different judgment on day one, so whole contractual service margin is different compared to a competitor, and therefore I really think, okay, why should we not give an allowance policy choice, and if a company wants to use a lock-in rate, they should do it consistently over all their kind of contracts, and others should use maybe a current rate if that is easy or not so costly. Because I think really, I understand the arguments, but if you look at the overall model with so many judgment, I would really think if this, because even you look at the numbers, between the different method, maybe it is 10% then of the release of the margin, which you have a difference during periods, but not overall it is zero, the impact. So that is really my point, man. I understand all that, but is it really worth to giving strict rules here and there? You have always to use this locked-in rate, and is it worth it from a cost-benefit perspective?
I think it is worth it from a cost-benefit point of view, because I can accept that you might want to use a current rate to, there's costs for both sides, with whichever way you go. And I can understand that you might say, well, the costs for the current P&L people is much greater than the relative costs for the OCI people, for instance, and so you want to choose a current rate. But I think giving an accounting policy choice on this isn't really a sensible thing to do, because it affects the measurement of the liability. And what you're then saying, by electing your accounting policy choice, you can affect your measurement of your liability, and that can be significant, because you can get differences of interest rates of about, I don't know, it used to be 7-9%, now it's 1-2%, over 40 odd years of compounding and accretion. You're talking a potentially very, very big impact, and you would effectively be saying that they have an accounting policy choice to choose between them, and potentially, we get to it later, change your accounting policy in a subsequent period as well. So I think, you know, if you want to go for a current rate, then go for a current rate, but then you should require that for everyone and accept the cost that that then imposes on the OCI people, rather than give a choice and let each have a lower cost, because although it's a one more assumption, it's a very significant assumption.
Andrew, just a question rather than a, we talk quite often in this case about the fact that it end up being a different liability, but wouldn't it also end up with a different total comprehensive income? Where under the
yeah.
under
over
the
time.
Yeah.
Yes, over the life of the contract. Yes, it would.
Stephen.
I also found this very difficult conceptual questions cost, complexity, and understandability. However, I've come down on the side of current rate, not locked-in rate. I think for those entities that are using P&L and not using OCI, requiring a locked-in rate is an enormous burden, because for the rest of the model, they're using current rates. They don't have to track historical interest rates, the yield curve, the EIR, whatever it is. And if we go with this locked-in rate, we're forcing them to keep all this information. So I think that's a significant burden for them. I also feel there's a problem with understandability, so from a user perspective, with using the locked-in rate. Because when we have a change in the estimated cash flows, for the balance sheet purposes, we do that change at the current rate and we change the liability. And we're going to unlock the CSM at the locked-in discount rate, and the balance for those using P&L will go in the P&L. But that balance could produce a rather counterintuitive result, in my view, that you could have a net increase in the best estimate liability. Let's say the net increase is 80, and you could end up with the CSM being reduced by 100 and the difference going into P&L, and you get this sort of counterintuitive effect where the entry within CSM is actually bigger than the change in the liability in the balance sheet, and it can obviously work different ways. Now, we saw that when we did those examples that we took to investors. ISA prepared that great spreadsheet illustrating the OCI mechanics and all sort of life of the contract. And we had exactly this thing. There was a change in an estimate, and it produced an unlocking effect, but it also produced a large amount, in that case, in OCI. If you were a P&L company, it would have gone to P&L. In that example, it went to OCI. And when we showed that to investors, they were pretty surprised that this entry was there, and they found it very difficult to understand. And I found it very difficult to explain why it was there. And for a P&L company, that entry would have appeared in the P&L. And I think it looks very odd when we're supposedly unlocking the margin, but not all of the effect of the change in the present value of cash flows goes to the margin, part of it ends up in P&L. So cost and understandability are two factors that have led me to the current rate. I think there is an argument conceptually for it. I don't think we are dealing with a revenue recognition standard. It is an insurance contract standard. We are using current discount rates. So I don't necessarily believe that the analogy with revenue recognition is fair. Now turning to the OCI companies, I recognize that locked-in rate kind of makes more sense, except that you get that very odd entry in OCI when there's a change in estimate, the one that we've had difficulty explaining, but I guess because it's in OCI, the users won't look at it anyway, so maybe it's not such of a problem. The difficulty for them with using current rate, I agree, is that the way you've structured it here is you don't get the full recycling, and you haven't said what the solution is, presumably some fudge to get it to recycle. I don't know. I don't know what you're proposing. The problem we have, and I think this is relates to what TAC was saying, is that we're not actually remeasuring the CSM. So when there's a change in interest rate, if we were to remeasure the CSM in the same way that we remeasure the liability, treating it like some notional cash flows, then actually all of our problems would be solved. Because then, in your example, there's a sort of a 34 floating in that in the end that doesn't recycle. Well, there would have been another entry of minus 34 in year one or year two arising from the remeasurement of the margin. So then all of those conceptual difficulties would have been solved, or practical difficulties, through that remeasurement. The remeasurement of the margin in that way for changes in discount rate would also solve another problem that some constituents have brought to us, which is where you have a regular premium policy and you have sort of offsetting best estimate asset and contractual service margin liability netting to zero when you're remeasuring one bit and not the other, and you don't have any assets, so you end up with volatility. Now that's sort of a 30-second explanation of an issue that was brought to us for regular premium contracts, and the people that came with it to us said, well, can't we put this volatility bit in OCI? I didn't see the conceptual basis for that, but that would be another solution for there. So I think there's a number of things which are going on in this. If I were to choose one approach, on balance, I would choose current rate for it. And you'd have to then go back and think about how to solve the problem of recycling for the OCI companies. Having said that, I'm quite sympathetic to what Pat said about accounting policy choice, to be honest. I'm not sure that I make it a choice. I would say for those portfolios where you're choosing P&L, current rate, for those portfolios where you're choosing OCI, I'd do locked-in rate. Nothing is entirely satisfactory in this area, and it's a question of balancing these different things.
That was your
suggestion. Yeah, that was my suggestion, to link the accounting policy election of OCI or P&L with a type of interest rate that goes better with it.
I prefer that to the free choice.
That's essentially what I was saying.
Daryl?
I guess two points that I wanted to pick up on from my side. The first one is perhaps to pick up on this last point that Steve raised, which I think is quite an important one, the idea of choice. I think up until now, a lot of the kind of comfort I've been able to get myself with the OCI thing is that it left the balance sheet unaffected, and it allowed me to go to total OCI, to total comprehensive income, and get the same answer, which meant that if I didn't like OCI, or if I was comparing one company that chosen OCI and one company that had not chosen OCI, I could actually use the balance sheet and the total comprehensive income to get to the same answer. And that gave me quite a lot of comfort about allowing the choice in the first place, because we had that ability to get back. A choice worries me because it changes those two elements, and so that you won't actually be getting back to the same answer. And that, I think, is fairly fundamental, because it means now you're really running two, not just presentation models, but actually two measurement models.
Yeah.
So that was a fairly big concern for me. The other point, and it's another one that...
It's still a choice. In fact, it
just kind of exaggerates the effect of that original choice that you were making. That just now flows through the process. The second issue, as I think you mentioned when you were quoting the 8 to 9% and the 2% and the 40 years, we're not necessarily talking about small numbers. These can be numbers that can become fairly big. I think the second element for me, in terms of the point that Stephen made about this income that sort of pops out for the profit and loss guys, and trying to explain what the heck that income is, and I suppose to an extent what that income is it is profit that company, or a loss that company previously reported on estimates that it included in its original estimate, that it's now no longer going to recognize. It's no longer going to realize that profit or loss, because that underlying cash flow that it was originally projecting is no longer going to occur, or a new cash flow that it was not expecting is going to occur. So to my mind, to say that you've, over a period of 3 or 4 years, built up a profit or a loss because of a change in future expectations, and now the interest rates have changed relative to that. Well, the rates have changed the first time, sorry. You've built up profit and loss because of changes in interest rates, and now because the thing that you were expecting to have happen in the future is no longer going to happen, it seems appropriate to me that then should be a loss that goes through profit, or if you recognized it in OCI, a reversal that goes through OCI. So I kind of think I get an answer that I can actually explain. I took a profit on something, I'm no longer going to get that something, so I can no longer recognize the profit, so I have a loss, or vice versa. So I'm still, and it then comes down probably to the point that Stephen was making. I think the last big one for me is this issue of how difficult the one is to do versus the other. And I think, unfortunately, that's where we are stuck with a bit of a tough one here, because no matter who we look at, no matter which choice we make here, somebody's going to have a hard thing to do. It's going to be difficult for one party or the other party.
I'm falling on the side of the locked-in rate, and I think I'm falling somewhat reluctantly, but because I agree with the principle, the underlying view, that this is akin to the IFRS 15 type of revenue allocation model. And if it is, then we need to apply the same sort of thought process we would there, I think.
I suppose that the question you raised, that if we would go for a county policy choice, that the comparability between the OCI and the P&L treatment would
change drastically.
That's a very important argument. I haven't realized that. Mary?
Maybe lowering the tone of the discussion by baby steps on accounting here for insurance, but if we go back to the basic point about having the change in the discount rate split out and reported in OCI, that's to give an amortized cost perspective in profit or loss, right? And
investing.
Right, and if that's the objective, then doesn't that just argue for locked in rate, because that's consistent with the whole reason we're looking at splitting the two? So I guess that feeds in to what, in some ways, what Steve was saying, although if you elect P&L, do one thing; if you elect OCI, the other. For the ones where you've got the choice. Although I am concerned about exacerbating the comparability challenges.
When you use an OCI, what you're doing effectively is you're taking the investing result and putting in OCI. Within a P&L world, you still have a separation of underwriting and investing result, but both of them are presented in P&L. And if you use a current rate, then you are still mixing those two subtotals.
Yeah, I guess that's at the heart of why, I guess you were saying, conceptually locked-in rate.
Yes, and it's much more. It's not just a presentation. The underwriting results are recognized in different periods, so actually it does have an effect on the recognition of the gains and losses, not only the presentation.
Okay, let's see if we can support the staff recommendation to choose for a locked-in rate. All in favor.
Can we also look at the modified recommendation, i.e. current rate for those who use P&L and locked-in for those?
Can we take the staff vote first? Staff vote, if it fails, then we'll look at that.
Yeah.
Vote for staff recommendation. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
I don't oppose that, but I prefer that we also look at the other one.
I think that's the
decision making.
I think that's actually the worst decision.
Yeah.
It's 9.
It was 9?
Nine.
Nine. Nine. Nine. That means we have to look at the combination of that. Okay. Okay,
so hopefully. Can I just finish? It should be, I hope, quick.
Yes.
All right.
Very good.
So paper 2C, if I may, deals with a minor follow-on issue which arises from your tentative decisions about the effects of changes in discount rate being presented as an accounting policy choice. And at the March meeting, you asked us to consider whether there's a need for additional requirements about when entities can change accounting policies. And so this paper looks at the existing requirements and it concludes that there's no need for additional requirements. The paper also looks at whether there's a need for a change to IAS 8 as a result of the interaction between the retrospective change in accounting policy that's required by IAS 8 for insurance contract liabilities and the prospective changes that might be made if you were to change the accounting for financial assets in accordance with IFRS 9. And again, we concluded that IAS 8 is already sufficient and no additional change to IAS 8 is needed. So as a result, our staff recommendation is that an entity should apply the requirements in IAS 8 to changes in accounting policy relating to the presentation of the effect of changes in discount rate. And my question really is whether you agree with that staff recommendation or whether you want.
Okay. Everybody happy? Steven?
No, I disagree. I don't think this is enough to deal with the changes in accounting policy. So if we take into account the assets that we hold in selecting the accounting policy, presumably when the assets change, that's a justification for changing the policy?
If it's a wholesale change, then you might well consider that you would change your accounting policy because of the extent of mismatches, for example.
Right.
I think we knew that when we decided, that was one of the reasons for giving a choice in the first place.
Okay, so when we then change the policy, do we apply it retrospectively?
Yes.
Which seems a bit silly because we still have the old assets in the previous period.
You may still have the old assets in the previous period. You might have actually, in fact, have had both sets of assets in the previous period, but you've just decided to back with one rather than with the other. The thing with IFRS 9 is that the assets business model is a thing of fact, and the accounting policy is a thing of choice. There's no requirement that you had to have chosen the right accounting policy to match what your assets are, so you could actually be doing less mismatch by changing accounting policy than before. For example, if you'd had your fair value P&L assets and you decided to account for your liability at fair value OCI, but then decide to change, it could be better than before. You can't say which way it is. So driving it on the basis of mismatches that might not have occurred, it could have been silly before and is now sensible. You can't assume it was sensible before and is now silly.
Any other comments? All right. All those in favour of the staff recommendation?
12 out of 13.
12. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11. 11.